This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
We're delighted that we have Roslyn Russell to speak to us today. And apart from Ros working at the museum here, Ros has been very much part of the Friends for quite some long while because Ros is our editor extraordinaire of our Friends magazine, and it would not look as it does without Ros's wonderful expertise. I have a nice little bit of biographical information here about Ros, so I'll just read that. Is a historian and museum specialist and editor of the Friends magazines, as I mentioned, and has been working part-time at the museum as a curator in gallery development. She is working on the Spirit of Inquiry module for the new gallery to be opened in 2011, as some of our other speakers are working on that that new gallery. She's been working in an area of history and museums for over 20 years, both in Australia and overseas, and she's the author of several books on Australian history. Her most recent publications are Ever Manning, Selected Letters of Manning Clark, 1938 to 1991, published in 2008, and the co-author of Significance 2.0, published last month by the Collections Council of Australia. She recently retired from the position of Managing Editor of Museums Australia magazine, which she held from late 2000. Rosalind's next book will be an illustrated biography of the ornithologist John Gould for the National Library of Australia to be published in 2010. She's also very involved in UNESCO's Memory of the World program, and Ros did come and speak to us about that some while ago, and I don't know if anyone was here, but it's a very fascinating program for the preservation of documentary heritage, and is a member of the International Advisory Committee, which will have its ninth meeting in Barbados next month. Well, see, you're going to go to some better weather too. Not a silly woman, this at all. So I'm delighted to introduce you to Roslyn Russell, and she's going to speak Spirit of Inquiry in Port Macquarie. So thanks so much, Ros, for coming today.
Thank you, Carolyn, for those kind words. And I'm speaking today about work I've been doing on Spirit of Inquiry in Port Macquarie. And Spirit of Inquiry is a module for our new permanent gallery that deals with scientific investigation in various places around the country. Port Macquarie is one, Townsville is another, and our own ANU, just across the way here, is the third. But I've chosen to talk about Port Macquarie today because it's got some fascinating storylines that I'm just going to briefly sketch for you in this time we have together. Spirit of Inquiry in Port Macquarie is focused around amateur science. Some of the other modules deal with medical science and other forms of applied science at the professional level. But the Port Macquarie one, we've chosen to look at amateur scientists working on their own interests in this particular place. And, of course, as you know, if you've been to other talks about the new permanent gallery, the connection between people and their activities in a place is fundamental to the new gallery's underlying ethos. So amateur science in Port Macquarie is the focus. And the amateur science that most comes through these storylines and exhibits is that of astronomy, although there are other amateur scientific pursuits that I also look at as well. Hence the setting sun going down over the mouth of the Hastings River, as you can see on your screen right here now. Before we go to Port Macquarie, though, I want to talk a bit about amateur science in New South Wales in the 19th century, because that's where our first storyline originates. And with the figure of Alexander Maclay, who came out to Australia in 1826 as colonial secretary. He was already a fellow of the Royal Society and an eminent person with a wonderful collection of entomology. And he brought with him his scientific enthusiasms and six of his children, because he was needed some money, because he was running into financial problems in England. And, of course, coming out of the colonies for a good job was a good way to repair your fortunes. Of course, we now know his name from the Maclay Museum in the University of Sydney. He and his family, the collections were the foundation collections for that wonderful museum at Sydney. But it's a bit of a side tangent in a sense, talking about Alexander Macleay. But I'm dragging him in and that context of colonial science because it was with his household that our first storyline interest, Annabella Boswell, was concerned. Alexander Macleay's household was unique, I suspect, in the early colonial society of New South Wales. It was one of educated women. The girls there studied, you can see on the screen, not just botany, but entomology, zoology, ornithology, marine biology, all the other ologies, astronomy, horticulture and landscape gardening. They were very well educated indeed. They had a wonderful library that had fantastic features, and its list of contents gives an insight, as Elizabeth Windschuttle says, to the first family of intellectuals in New South Wales. What was in their library? All these things. It was a wonderful collection that was brought out to what was pretty much a wasteland intellectually for a long time, until people like Alexander Macleay promoted colonial science and created the core of a nucleus of people who were interested in scientific pursuits. He was one of the foundational inspirations for the first actual museum founded in New South Wales, the Australian Museum, founded in 1827 in his office in the Colonial Secretary's department. So you can see that the family of the Macleays, particularly the girls, were very much better educated than many of their peers. One of them, Fanny Macleay, was herself a very keen botanical illustrator and was very, and in these days, of course, would have had a wonderful professional career. Quickly, so keep those ideas about Alexander Macleay and his family connections and his family ethos in your minds as I keep on talking. Because we're heading up the coast to Port Macquarie and to a man called Archibald Innes. Archibald Innes was the commandant of the convict settlement at Port Macquarie in 1826 that had been established in 1821. He wasn't particularly successful in that job, but while he was in Port Macquarie, he had a chance to scope out the territory and see what kind of place it was going to be. It was the entrepot for a hinterland full of timber and things like that, and access to the New England plateau. And he, as soon as he was discharged from his army position, as soon as free settlement was allowed in the area, he applied for a land grant. And in the same year as he applied for a land grant, he married Margaret Macleay, the daughter of Alexander Macleay, one of these well-educated women from the Macleay household. And they went to live up at a place called Lake Burrowan by the Aboriginal people. He promptly called it Lake Innes after himself. The construction of his estate began in 1831 and was completed in 1839 with the help of much convict labour. Of course, the system was that you got your land grant and you applied for a number of convicts. You then had to bear the expense of those convicts' board and lodging, but they gave you free labour. Many, many colonial fortunes, of course, were based on this system. Archibald Innes was from a well-connected family. He came from Scotland, from a place called Thrumster. He devised his own coat of arms. You can see it there on one of his book plates. This was completely illegal and unofficial. The College of Arms in London knew nothing about it, but he had his own ideas about what his coat of arms should look like and had it reproduced. Just before we go on to his, this is some of the traces of the colonial era that he would have known in Port Macquarie. Some graves on the hill above Town Beach showing the grave of a man who was shot by escaping convicts. So Archibald Innes built a magnificent house called Lake Innes House. There's a little model in the Port Macquarie Historical Museum, a little bit kitschy model, little plastic flowers and so on, but it does give you an idea of the kind of thing it is. It was a U-shape with a central tower from which he could look out across the water and see his ships, because he had shipping interests as well as agricultural interests in Lake Innes itself, see his ships coming up towards the harbour mouth at Port Macquarie. And the inside of the house was very luxurious. It was fabled amongst people who visited. They came and saw the luxury of this, what was to people from Britain, a colonial outpost. Damask wallpaper, chandeliers, beautiful paintings and artworks. There was a painting there. Someone came in and said, "Oh, a Paolo." And here in New South Wales, colonial New South Wales, in the 1830s, it actually wasn't a painting by Paolo Veronese, but it was by his son. But nevertheless, Innes owned some remarkable artworks and also a remarkable library. He also had a huge stables complex, a very extensive, very well-built stables. He boasted he could mount any guest that came to stay, so that people were... His hospitality was legendary. He's also obviously extremely extravagant. And one of the people to whom he extended hospitality over a long period was his niece, Annabella Innes, who was later Annabella Boswell. Annabella was the daughter of his brother George, and she and her mother and sister and their father had stayed at Lake Innes House in the late 1830s for George's health. He was poorly. I suspect he probably had tuberculosis, as many people did in those days, and he gradually faded and he died in 1841. And after going backwards and forwards from various properties, Mrs. Innes and Annabella and her sister Margaret came to live up at Lake Innes House with their uncle, who said to her mother, "My house is yours, you sit at my right hand, everything I have is open to you." And so they were there. His hospitality was extended for about 6 or 7 years to this family of his brother. And Annabella Innes is our first character in this story. She was a young girl. She came there about the age of 14 and was up to about the age of 18 or so, 18 to 20. And she kept a journal, a very meticulous journal. She was a meticulous observer and she was also a botanical watercolourist. Where did she learn all these skills? In the household of the Macleays in Sydney. Because when she lived in Sydney, she was at school there, but it wasn't very satisfactory, and the Macleays took her in. And she became a special protege of Fanny Maclay, the lady I mentioned before, who was a botanical watercolourist and scientist, who wanted to adopt her. She was so keen on her, but she didn't, of course. And but she learned at the feet of these educated women in the Maclay household the kinds of skills of observation that she brought to her journal, to her observations of the night sky, and to her botanical watercolours. So there she is, as a young girl, probably in her mid-teens at the time she wrote her journal. That's a photograph that's held in the Port Macquarie Historical Museum. And she talks about in her journal, she actually wrote the journal at the time, but then she, much later in life, she went back and revisited it. So the journal, as it was published, first of all in the late 19th century and then again in 1965, is essentially her going back, looking at it, interpolating some in material as commentary, and then there's verbatim reports. And she talks about even looking back, say, 20, 30 years later, she remembers her day of coming, of the first day she came to live at Lake Innes House, and she describes the beauty of the environment, the lovely gardens, how gorgeous it was, and obviously in memory it lived on for her. That's what it looks like today. It's still pretty, still quite nice, but the beautiful gardens, the beautiful house and so on, of course, are well and truly not there anymore. But it's still a lovely setting. She was educated by another Maclay woman. Her aunt, Margaret Innes, formerly Margaret Maclay, who'd married Archibald, was her tutor there. So she carried on the education provided by her sister Fanny in Sydney. Annabella reflects, of course, as a mother herself, she had about 4 children when she finally grew up. She reflects on how her aunt had time to devote, or she may manage to make the time to educate all these children she had. She had 2 children of her own, plus the 2 girls, or 3 children, sorry, 2 daughters and a son, and the 2 girls from her brother-in-law's family. And you can see the kinds of things they did. They went at 10 o'clock to school. They read the sort of usual religious things that people did in those days. And they had lessons, and they wrote to dictation and so on. So obviously they were very apt pupils, and she was a very diligent teacher. They had access also, of course, to the books that Archibald Innes had in his library. There's various things here that a few things are still held by the Port Macquarie Historical Museum. And in 1843, just a year after she came to live at Lake Innes, there was a comet. The comet of 1843, not Halley's Comet, but a precedent one. And Annabella put her powers to observation to use, and here's where we have our connection with colonial astronomy, because she gave to us, as to posterity, a detailed description of what this comet looked like. And I'll give you just one example. This went over 2 weeks. So she talks about the day they watched for the comet, it appeared, she talks about what it looks like, and she gives quite a detailed description of how it's positioned in relation to other stars. She knows the astro terms like the zenith, for example, and there's more of this. This goes on for a fortnight. So she does give a very precise and detailed description. And remember, this is a girl of probably about 14, 15, which is quite impressive that she was so diligent about recording this natural phenomenon. She also, of course, took up the painting wildflowers. She would have been taught wildflower painting or flower painting in Sydney by school teachers and by Fanny McClay. But she did. There's a story that goes along with this. This her talking of her former love of drawing, reviving. What had happened was she'd had one teacher who didn't like the way she painted or drew. She said, no, that's no good. That's bad practice. You must do this. And she gave them sort of classical busts and other and pictures to copy and things like that, and which basically stifled her creativity and made her work in a very formulaic kind of way. But she, once free from that influence and seeing the flowers in their natural environment around Port Macquarie, it sparked her interest in botanical illustration again. And Dido was her cousin. They resolved to paint at least one wildflower per week. I mean, this is very typical of Annabella Boswell. She has programs of things that she's going to do. She also makes lots of clothes and things like that and has lots of gossipy conversations in her journal. But you can see the sense of a young woman very determined to record things properly and to have a program of work that she carried out on a regular basis. And here are some of her... This is not very good photographs, I'm afraid, but we will get much better ones for the exhibition in the gallery. This is the convolvulus plant, of course, and various other things here that you will see in all their... in much better form when we borrow these things from the Port Macquarie Historical Museum for the gallery next year. Lake Innes House, where Annabella lived, is now a ruin. It's one of the few genuine ruins in Australia. We don't have very many ruins, but this one is. It's not particularly Gothic, but it's interesting to see what the grand house that Archibald Innes created has come to today. It was a bit like Sleeping Beauty's castle. You can see the convict-made bricks, and if you have a look later, there's one on the table here. It's one that was lent to me very kindly by the Port Macquarie Historical Museum. And if you have a look at it, you'll see something that you can see if you look very carefully here. And that's called a frog mark. There's about six different frog marks from the Lake Innes archaeological collection of bricks made by individual convict makers. And they made them from clay on the estate, baked them there. The whole thing was sort of self-sufficient. He had a home farm and all those kinds of things as well. And each maker had his own mark. And you'll see that brick there has the I mark, which actually stands for Innes. Someone decided to put Innes rather than their own mark on it. And here are the ruins of those magnificent stables. They're quite amazing, very extensive, very well built. Archibald Innes was able to command the best colonial artisans. He really could pick and choose the best people to work for him. Unfortunately, I mentioned Sleeping Beauty's castle before, Margaret Innes had access to lots of botanical cuttings because, of course, Alexander Macleay was part of that great network of people who were sending plants around the globe that Sir Joseph Banks promoted from Kew Gardens, where they were transplanting things from one colony to the next or from England out to Australia and other colonies as well. And Margaret Innes is credited, or otherwise, with bringing into this country lantana. We don't know whether we thank her for that or not. These are examples of I haven't got any lantana, or mice or thorn, but she brought bamboo, which this huge canopy of bamboo you can still see there is at the entranceway to what would have been the grand entrance of Lake Innes House. A ginger plant down there and the briar rose that Macleay called the MacArthur rose. So until about the 50s and 60s, this whole site was engulfed by this stuff. You can imagine there are these bits of brickwork sticking up out of nowhere and masses and masses of this kind of invasive vegetation all over the place. And the National Parks and Wildlife got into it and they've cleared it and they've made it a site you can now go to and visit. It's well worth a visit if you go to Port Macquarie to go on a guided tour of the site. This is what remains of the residential block of Lake Innes House. Think of those damask wallpapers and chandeliers and so on, and the Veronese painting and all the rest of it. It's one of those sort of things come to ruin stories, I'm afraid. There's a picture of Annabella Boswell as she was later in life. She married and went to Scotland. She was born in Australia, obviously, and never returned to Australia, but she had an enormous fondness for the place. And somehow or other, her watercolour sketches and her diaries and her pictures, her photographs, or photographs of her, have fetched up in Port Macquarie again. And we're able to borrow them for this exhibition. Yes, she married a man called Patrick Charles Douglas Boswell, one of the one of the great big, the large Boswell family that included the Boswell of Samuel Johnson. He was employed in the Bank of New South Wales. Then he inherited the family estate and. She died in 1914, so she lived a very long life. So her life spans almost the next person we're going to talk about. This is just one of the volumes of her journal from Port Macquarie, one of the ones we'll be borrowing for the exhibition. And we go on to our next story, William John McDonnell, who was also in Port Macquarie, and he was there from the 1880s to 1910. He actually died before Annabella Boswell did. But he didn't die in Port Macquarie either. William John McDonnell was more seriously in the amateur but highly successful amateur astronomer area. Annabella, of course, was a young girl recording and very meticulously recording natural phenomena, but he was a serious scientific observer. If you've been down in the hall recently, you'll have seen the telescope, and that is the signature object for the Spirit of Inquiry module for the new gallery, and that was owned by William John McDonnell. But before that, he was well connected to the scientific instrument fraternity because his father was one of the principals of Brush and McDonnell, who were makers and retailers of scientific instruments in Sydney. So he had a family background in scientific instrumentation, so an interest in science, presumably as a result. We're going to be borrowing this pocket sextant sold by William McDonnell's father. It's in the collection of the Powerhouse Museum. William McDonnell, as well as being an amateur astronomer, was also a bank official, and he, like Patrick Boswell, worked for the Bank of New South Wales. And this is the Bank of New South Wales building in Port Macquarie, which was relatively new when he came there in the mid-1880s to manage the bank. And that's a ledger we're going to borrow from the Westpac archives showing his signature up there, sort of third from the top, I think, as bank manager at Port Macquarie. And he built an observatory behind the bank, a little dinky little wooden number there with a dome and all the rest of it, and an aperture to put, you can see the telescope pointing out and him standing in front of it. This is from a thing called the Morton Album, which is held at Port Macquarie, which has these wonderful photographs of Port Macquarie going right back to the, sort of the late 1800s, 19th century, and including these wonderful examples of photographs of William MacDonald and his observatory, which housed the telescope that you can see downstairs in the hall. And when we found this photograph, it was tremendous because Kirsten Wayner's father, Herman, who's a friend of the museum, was in the process of fixing up the MacDonald's telescope, and we're able to, well, I believe Kirsten tells me that they were very pleased to have these photographs so that they could look at how it was assembled in situ. So this is the wonderful telescope that's downstairs. I won't talk about it much here because the information is down there and you can read it better than I can talk about it. But it's a fantastic object, and it's really exciting to think it's going to be our signature object for Spirit of Inquiry. But this was used in Port Macquarie for transits and observations that were made by William John MacDonald. He'd already been involved with professional astronomers at Sydney Observatory for a transit of Venus in the 1870s, and he continued to feed information to those observatories throughout his career. And here's an example of a page from his transit observations that he made with this telescope at Port Macquarie Observatory. That's his own personal observatory, of course, from 1885 to 1887. And we're going to be borrowing those from the State Library of New South Wales. Here's a picture of him in later life. He fell on hard times. He was a victim of, as was Alex, I forgot to mention Archibald Innes. He fell on hard times in a major depression in the 1840s and had to give up Lake Innes House and become a gold commissioner up in Newcastle. William MacDonald had to sell his telescope in 1895. He couldn't afford to keep it, and he had to sell it to, you know, raise some funds as a result of the 1890s depression. These things tend to be a persistent refrain. But he continued to make observations with other scientific instruments, but he sold it on and it passed through various hands, including other astronomers, and finally came to rest here at the museum as part of the National Historical Collection. And the last person I want to talk about is a man called Thomas Dick. He wasn't an astronomer. He was an oyster culturist. He came from a family that virtually pioneered the oyster culture business in the Hastings. Weren't always that popular with other people because they kind of appropriated some of the best parts of the river for growing oysters. But he was also a very keen amateur scientist. He was interested in everything. He was interested in mineralogy. He was interested in Aboriginal culture. He was interested in the scientific aspects of oyster culturing. The Australian Museum would buy lots of specimens from him of slates of oysters. And he once sent a letter to them saying he had a fantastic theory about mineral specimens in their collections. And could he write an article for their museum journal, because he had a revolutionary theory about how these sort of petrified fossils had come to be. And the curator wrote back and said, I think that the Australian Museum Journal is too modest a violet for a revolutionary theory. So they weren't going to be sticking their necks out anytime soon about revolutionary theories from Thomas Dick. But he was very respected. He was a fellow of the Royal Society of New South Wales. He had articles on Aboriginal cultural objects published in their journal, and we'll be borrowing one of those also for Spirit of Inquiry. But one of the most important things he did was to record the traditional life of the Indigenous people, the Birrarri people of the Hastings, in photographs for between about 1910 and 1927. Here he is with up to his knees in water in the Hastings with oysters. That's what he did for a living. But he had a tremendous collection of Aboriginal artefacts, all sorts of geological material, things like that. Tragically, when he died, his wife discarded a lot. It's a sad story about his death, but it's a sad sequel too, that his wonderful collections, which he had offered to the Australian Museum, which had rejected them, were dispersed or just discarded. His family business, of course, was oyster culturing. This is a picture I took up at Port Macquarie at a place called Mud Creek, which is, should be called Mosquito Creek, because about 10 entered the car with us as soon as we jumped in, they followed us in. Tremendously rich for oysters, as you can see. But he recorded the activities of the Bear Pie people in hundreds and hundreds of photographs taken over these years. He was a very good photographer, and what he did was have these people who weren't living a particularly traditional lifestyle, of course, we're talking about the early years of the 20th century now, they were persuaded to assume the roles, the role-play traditional life in locations around the Hastings. And we can pick out some of those locations today. I'm not sure that's quite the right location there, but there is an Aboriginal man up there who is going to help us with putting locations with Thomas Dick photographs. So here's a gentleman standing on a sandhill with a boomerang and a shield that Thomas Dick set that particular picture up. And that's the kind of location. I went to some of the locations where we know that he took some of the photographs. This is another one. Here they are in their canoes and spearing fish at one of the waterways around the Hastings, Port Macquarie area. That's a place called Lake Cattai, and we know that Thomas Dick took photographs of Aboriginal people, you know, in this kind of situation in Lake Cattai, or around Lake Cattai. Here's another one here, and that's Mud Creek, where the oysters were. So these are the kinds of locations in which he posed people. He also went into the mountains with them for days at a time to do other poses as well. Sadly, this is another place where he took photographs, Tacking Point. Many of them were taken around Tacking Point. And it was at Tacking Point on his 50th birthday that Thomas Dick drowned. And this is a picture of Tacking Point today. So it's rather sad to think that many of the photographs that we know him for, and there are very many hundreds of them, they're held in museums around the world, but there's some held in Iatsis, just across the road here, in the Australian Museum, in the Queensland Museum, the Museum of Anthropology and Ethnology in Cambridge. So he has a worldwide reach in terms of his representations of Aboriginal people, taken around Port Macquarie. So the Thomas Dick photograph collection is a very significant photographic collection. I mean, it's not pretending to be recording Aboriginal people in there as they were at the time, because clearly they were not living a traditional lifestyle, but he got to them early enough for them to be able to remember what their traditional life ways were, and has preserved for us a record of their traditional life in these series of photographs. Port Macquarie is about to open, if it hasn't already opened, a big new cultural facility called the Glassworks, and they're going to have a big display of Thomas Dick photographs in there. So if you're in Port Macquarie at any time, it's worth having a look at the Glassworks exhibition. They're going to also have Indigenous implements in the floor and things like this. But one of the agreements that they've done the whole thing with the agreement of the local Aboriginal community, and there are various agreements as to what they can and can't show. And we, of course, will abide by the same agreements. We will be having, for Spirit of Inquiry, a slideshow presentation of some of the Thomas Dick photographs, hopefully interspersed with the kind of locations that he took, pictures of the kind of locations that he took the photographs in. So that's a brief survey of the three major stories we have about Port Macquarie. There's a couple of little side stories. One of them is about the persistence of astronomy in amateur science and astronomy in Port Macquarie today. It's amazing how things thread through the history of a place. From Annabella with her comet observations in 1843, William MacDonald with his quite developed observatory, providing valuable observations of the night sky around Port Macquarie in the early 1900s, right through to today when there's now still an observatory in Port Macquarie up on the hill above Town Beach, and a very keen astronomical association. It was opened in the 1960s by the then government astronomer of New South Wales, Harley Wood, and I was interested in that because I've written a book on Harley Wood, so I was quite interested to see that he was the one who had opened the observatory. And they have a telescope, obviously. They have night viewings there, so people often have quite crowded nights during the week where people, often many tourists in Port Macquarie, it's a big holiday place, as you know. And so astronomy is alive and well in Port Macquarie today. They also have, as a connection to the bigger professional astronomical world, they have an orrery, a model of the solar system that was made in Sydney Observatory by Harley Wood made by his instrument maker Horace Pinnock, and obviously supervised by Harley Wood. So the connection between Port Macquarie and a major observatory is still maintained by this artefact that is in the Port Macquarie Observatory. So Port Macquarie and amateur science is still a persistent story, and if you ever do go to Port Macquarie, it's worth having a look at. It's at the museum where they have Annabella Boswell's artefacts, and at the observatory where you can still see the night sky if you go there. Thanks very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.